It's The Wonky Show. Free speech guidance has landed at university 6 weeks before it kicks in. We'll have a look what it says. Ottoline Lacer warns of a shake-up in UK research. It's all coming up.
For all the policy and regulation we put around it, I actually wonder whether the through line through some of these tensions is actually just helping staff to be a little bit more comfortable being in and among students and talking with them.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Jim Dickinson, and here to dissect the week's developments, as usual, three excellent guests. In Manchester, Mark Peace is Professor of Innovation in Education at King's College London. Mark, your highlight of the week, please.
So my highlight of the week is a set of conversations with staff at King's about our new emerging strategy to make more of the extracurricular space. And I had a lovely morning yesterday with our careers service leadership team, with a really engaged, switched on, sparky conversation about possibility.
Fantastic. In London this week, Aarti Saraswat is Senior Policy Manager for Higher Education at the Association of Colleges. Aarti, your highlight of the week, please.
Yes, my highlight of the week follows on from the recent announcement to establish technical excellence colleges in construction as set out in Labour's manifesto commitment. Techs will help grow skills capacity in the construction sector, and in line with the industrial strategy, there will hopefully be more techs to come in due course.
Fantastic. And in Basingstoke this week, Livia Scott is Partnerships Coordinator at Wonky. Livia, your highlight of the week, please.
This week, we had our team meeting and it ended with us all having a nice crisp glass of white wine on the river in the sun. So that was the favourite part of the day.
The main thing was free baguettes. That was what?
Oh, yes. We got free baguettes and free sourdough and cake. Honestly, best day ever.
There you go. There may or may not have been an obsession with cake then when I have uploaded some things to the site. But anyway, we'll start this week with OFS. This new free speech guidance. 44 days before duties on it go live, but 389 days since it closed the consultation, OFS has published some help. Livia, what does it say?
It's quite exciting this week. It is, if you've been kind of watching the ping pong of this legislation over the past, 3 years are we into now? But the Office for Students, as Jim said, has published guidance on how to implement and respond to academic freedom and free speech requirements. That comes into force very, very soon on the 1st of August. It is a very hefty document to through. And you know, this comes despite the fact that the OFS originally said it wasn't going to produce guidance, and it moves us away from the draft guidance that came back from the consultation back in March. Obviously, since then, Labour have kind of come into power and there's been changes and a general rethink about the and reposition of free speech law. So, for example, student unions will no longer be directly regulated. So all the time that Jim and I spent over the past 2 years kind of talking to student unions about that kind of became moot. But anyway, the guidance focuses on the duties providers have to secure free speech as defined within the law and what a free speech code of conduct could look like. What's really good about this guidance is it does offer up a whole kind of swathe of examples on how institutions should and should not respond if they wanted to stay within the requirements of the law. And it adds a lot more detail into the examples, and a lot of the examples that are given are a lot more realistic than in previous drafts. And the topics they go over are the contentious and potentially difficult topics. And, you know, if you've been following the culture war stuffs in the broadsheets, you can probably guess the sorts of scenarios that are in the guidance. And there's no guidance as of yet to kind of promote the duty, and the extent to kind of which the previous version stayed around that has been removed. But it covers things like social media harassment, putting posters up on notice boards, external speaker engagements again. But it's also accompanied by polling by YouGov from last spring, which asked teaching and research staff how free they feel to express their views on controversial topics. 1 in 5 academics on both the left and right of the political spectrum said they didn't feel very free or not at all free to teach controversial topics, and this rose to 1 in 3 who said they were kind of afraid to discuss things more generally, and a small number of staff saying that they felt like they needed to self-centre. So, but yeah, there's lots in there, there's a lot to unpick, and if I was in a university right now, I'd be feeling pretty hot under the collar for the next 44 days.
Not just because of the weather. Now, OFS's Director for Academic Freedom and Freedom of Speech, Arif Ahmed, has been on the Today programme this morning. Let's have a little listen.
In the long run, and historically, and we can see this if you look at a standout example of the American Civil Rights Movement, but there are many other examples. In the long run, it is minorities, and it is those who are often the most oppressed who benefit the most from an atmosphere of freedom of speech in general. Because when you are at the weakest point in society, it's words perhaps the only thing you can have, and the freedom to organise and speak out is essentially what in the long run will protect minorities. Coming to your question about what protections there are, the law, of course, provides a range of protections for minorities and the Equality Act and various other bits of legislation. We have also said in our guidelines that the essential function of university includes learning doing teaching or research. And clearly, whether it's minorities or anyone else, if there's an atmosphere or if there's speech, for instance, by an academic, or if there's activities which mean that they can't engage in their educational opportunities, for instance, because of intimidatory harassment, then that too would not be protective.
Now, Mark, we should probably start with this polling, shouldn't we? Because, if one in five academics don't feel comfortable to teach controversial views and a quarter of them are worried about physical threat, we should worry, shouldn't we?
Yeah, Jim. So I'm left reflecting a little bit about whether this is actually mapping onto a broader pedagogic challenge. There's a chunk of the sector that doesn't feel comfortable talking with students at all about anything. And it's a tiny chunk. And I think there's also still a default pedagogy across the sector that is about transmitting knowledge and isn't necessarily comfortable with more kind of dialogic and conversational ways of working with students. And part of me wonders about the intersection of that one in five who are nervous about talking about controversial issues with students and how much it overlaps with the group of staff who might be more uncomfortable with talking about with students in general. And I also wonder whether there is something here that is about a climate rather than a set of policies in universities. I don't get a sense of universities having policies that make staff directly nervous about raising things that are difficult with students. But I wonder if there is a broad adversarial culture that has come from a market positioning of students as consumers and our worry about their satisfaction and what that feedback is going to be, that has been layered on with like an internalized culture wars anxiety that's actually bubbling up through this. So for all the policy and regulation we put around it, I actually wonder whether the through line through some of these tensions is actually just helping staff to be a little bit more comfortable being in and among students and talking with them.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I was thinking, Mark, was, I mean, again, I don't want to minimize, you know, the some of the findings in here, but it strikes me that there are some subjects that you can study at university that don't have a lot of controversy in them, right? You know, even if there's a kind of dialogic kind of teaching method, and you know, sometimes, you know, there are just some realities about, you know, more academic or theoretical versus kind of vocational programs. But, you know, there are some subjects that just aren't as controversial in the way that this is obviously framed. And, you know, I wonder about the extent to which we should expect every student to kind of engage in debates about, you know, these sorts of things. You know, not every university is kind of research intensive, thinking about theory in the world, is it?
No, absolutely. And I guess there's something when you then ask that question, do you feel comfortable teaching controversial issues, where the answer is no, because I don't really know about them in that kind of context, then maybe that is also surfacing through this survey.
Yeah, I'm studying, you know, whatever. Why are you suddenly banging on to me about whatever? Yeah. Artie, you know, I mean, one of the big things in the consultation was a real sense, I think, that the original draft felt like it had been written around a set of concerns and a set of assumptions about a very particular type of HE, a type of HE that you very much do not represent, deal with, and support.
That is indeed the case, Jim. I think the guidance has quite a lot of examples, and they're quite helpful. They do feel like they're realistic. However, I would probably still feel that the examples don't really relate that much to the college context. I mean, college context is very different, as you would probably know. I mean, free speech has not really been a pressing matter for the FE sector, and there is no evidence that this has been a burning or a pressing concern for higher education within further education. And there are understandable reasons for this as well. For example, college tutors are not involved in researching politically sensitive subjects, and they're often not active researchers. College higher education is characterized by its vocational employment-focused curriculum, and visiting speakers are often industry experts talking about technical or business-specific content. Student unions, again, are quite different. They're often run by under-18s for some voluntary activities, but there are no student societies inviting controversial speakers, for example. SUs are small, sort of voluntary groups and colleges involved in sort of course representation, volunteering, sports, and similar activities. So I think it's fair to say that, you know, the context for college higher education is very different, and the examples, although quite, they feel real from a university standpoint, I can't see how they would relate very much to further education colleges still.
Olivia, I guess some of the examples are so ridiculous as to be kind of cartoon-like. You know, one of the ones I put, I think, in the blog this morning, whenever it was overnight, which is one about a college having having students wanting to hand out leaflets and a college saying you're only allowed to put them on one notice board. The notice board is small and you have to apply, I don't know, 8 weeks before, you know, you kind of put stuff out, and that would be a disproportionate restriction. But I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because on the one hand, it introduces, you know, it's very clear that if you want to say, well, I feel harassed, you have to kind of meet a certain very clear, specific legal threshold. But on the other hand, the Office for Students reserves the right to say, well, that might chill free speech, or that might chill free speech. And that doesn't seem to have any particular, you know, kind of threshold or special test or objective test. You know, OFS can just kind of pick on a thing and say, well, that looks like a chilling effect.
Yeah, I think when I was reading through the guidance, and when I say reading, I mean skimming, I was reading through it, and the thing, what was really useful about it was when it kind of was defining, you know, what constitutes as harassment, and being able to kind of look at when something is harassment and when it is harassment and isn't kind of infringing on somebody's free speech. So I think some of the examples were about the kind of social media abuse and that kind of thing. And some of the examples were genuinely more useful than the E6 guidance, which also comes into force in the next few weeks. But the bit that kind of worried me was that it feels like the OFS is kind of, you know, Arif Ahmed's in the press this week being like, I will be neutral. Like the OFS as a regulator will be neutral. But I don't know if you can be neutral when you're kind of deciding, you've been very clear about, you know, when individual conduct constitutes as harassment, either within the law or kind of on campus. But then there's also, you know, OFS basically gets to decide when something could chill, not because they're proven that it could chill something, just because they think, oh, well, that might have a chilling effect on campus. Yeah. And it was like, there was some stuff, a report that came out early in the week around kind of prevent cases and looking at that the OFS were kind of looking at. And I think it was people basically, the summary of who had returned and kind of how many reports to prevent had there been over the past, I think it was 23 to 24. And David Smarty, he was pretty disapproving of the kind of trend. He said that there's basically a chilling effect on free speech because there's been mitigations and conditions put in place to enable events to go ahead. So for example, you know, there's a controversial speaker, so universities have put things like security in place. You know, you need to get a ticket, you need to have a chair to chair the discussion. But it was only 3% of the events. And personally, I don't think 3% constitutes as a chilling effect. And it just feels really disproportionate, I think. And I'm concerned, I guess, that OFS has taken a very clearly political position, but saying that they're neutral.
Mark, I don't know what you think about this, but, you know, obviously in August, there's, as well as this, there's a new duty to kind of, in England, a new duty to prevent and, you know, kind of prosecute harassment and sexual misconduct. And whenever I'm in a room with a group of students and someone says, you know, can you talk to them about harassment? You're about 4 minutes away from ending up talking about where the line is between harassment and free speech and vice versa. And I'm not convinced, having, you know, read this all the way through, that I'm any clearer on how I handle a really tricky conversation, which will be, you know, if you've got to talk to all new students in September about harassment, you know, you're probably not going to have long for that conversation, even if it is a conversation. I'm not sure that conversation is straightforward when a student says, yeah, but what about, or what about, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and of course, this has been the stuck record on this since the very first mootings in the depths of the culture war, that actually the line between free speech and protection against harassment and discomfort and inclusion is really, really blurry. And at no point have we actually moved this forward any in the conversation. I know in this particular set of guidance, quite the heavy lifting that the phrase depending on the context may, which seems to be deployed.
Almost certainly a keyboard shortcut in the Office of Students.
It is. Every single time any case study actually drifts into some of those really, really difficult things, there's the caveat of depending on the context. And I think in that sense, this doesn't move us on anywhere.
Yeah. And that, you know, makes the conversations with new students quite difficult, doesn't it? Because, you know, you're kind of setting new expectations. I guess the other question, Artie, is, you know, of course it is the case that the education is different generally across the piece in the further education sector. But I guess other people would say, why is it only, you know, posh kids in the Russell Group get to debate, you know, contentious issues? Why isn't it that, you know, students in the further education sector get to discuss, you know, the big issues of the day? Isn't your position on this a chilling effect?
That's an interesting question, Jim, I would say, because I think one needs to remember who are the students who are studying in further education, what age brackets they fall into. And I think, you know, it's not because we are deliberately sort of trying to kind of, you know, constrain any debatable or any controversial issues, but it's just all back to the kind of curriculum, the type of courses that we are teaching, the types of students. I mean, particularly when it comes to students under the age of 18. Now, one of the things, for example, you know, the thing that I picked up in this guidance, which I think was quite helpful, is where the OFS has actually made some progress, know, by addressing some of the areas where the free speech could possibly intersect with other legal and statutory obligations that the providers may have to comply with. For example, in paragraph 64 and 65, I think it rightly states that if a provider or a constituent institution is required by law not to do something, then permitting the speech would be unlawful and therefore not reasonably practicable. And I think it kind of extends to say that it would be reasonably practicable for a further education college to breach the statutory, it would not be reasonably practicable for a further education college to breach the statutory requirements on safeguarding that apply to students under the age of 18. And that's quite an important point, because I think it's something that we had raised with the OFS, with our through our consultation response and otherwise, because it goes back to how do you explain to young people, how do you explain to 16 to 18 year olds, and colleges teach students as young as 14 sometimes, how do you explain to them, you know, what really are the underpinning principles of freedom, freedom of speech? And, you know, and for them, you know, sometimes telling students not to use sort of, you know, offensive language could be a breach of their freedom of speech. Telling them to turn their mobile phones off in a classroom could be a breach of their freedom. If you put that into that context, then I think you're talking about a very different mix of students, and you're also talking about different types of sort of, you know, students who might be studying on further education courses as well as higher education courses. And I think therefore this clarification in the guidance helpfully has taken this a step further forward, I would say.
Livia, I do want to pick up this issue of kind of structural issues and patterns, because it strikes me that, you know, one of the really big sort of underpinning genuine debates in the kind of campus culture wars runs something like this, which is, on the one hand, there's a bunch of people that would say, look, for example, racism and discrimination isn't just about kind of overt acts of harassment, you know, kind of graffiti or physical attacks or whatever. Quite often it's insidious. It's about a pattern. It's about, you know, what the EHRC in 2019 called microaggressions. On the other hand, there's a large group of people, you know, many of them academics, who will say, actually, when you start to promote that kind of culture, what you do is you divide people, and, you know, people self-censor because, you know, for fear of offending, and people end up not discussing controversial issues. Now, at various points throughout the guidance, despite the kind of claims of apolitical, it picks a side in that debate, doesn't it?
Yeah, it fully picks a side. And if you look back, which you've done in your piece, if you look back at kind of things that Arif Ahmed said when he was a Cambridge philosopher academic, obviously still is, but, you know, when he wasn't the free speech czar, the sorts of things that he complained about were, for example, report and support tools that basically would allow students to anonymously report things that, you know, they may have experienced, whether that be microaggressions, whether that be harassment, and kind of opened it up to a broader range of things, which, you know, brilliant. So many student union officers spent a lot of time kind of campaigning for encouraging students to complain and creating an environment and a culture in which students can say when they feel uncomfortable, when something's, you know, being able to report microaggressions, which we all know are intensely underreported. Arif Ahmed was basically saying, you know, this is a snitch's charter and people aren't going to want to engage with anybody who basically isn't white because they're worried that they might, a remark that they say might be misunderstood and reported. And I think it, obviously that's blown out of proportion, but there's a real kind of court of people who truly do believe that is happening. And I think the fear is that I think OFS has picked that side, that Arif Ahmed, I imagine, that reflects kind of his views. And there's a question for me about kind of whether that is legally justifiable, you know, kind of to do that. But I was quite surprised to read that opinion around microaggressions and thinking, you know, I think back to the things that I did when I was a student union officer and the things that I was championing, which were things around kind of decolonizing the curriculum and all of that. Would that be allowed now? Would I kind of be infringing on somebody's free speech for encouraging people to look at their kind of the things that they teach and, you know, making sure that it's not all kind of from a white European background? According to this, maybe.
Mark, I guess the other thing that really strikes me about this is that, you know, certainly in the previous polling we've done, it feels like a lot of this is about people having a lack of confidence, right? And, you know, there's a way of reading the both the staff polling and the previous kind of student polling that isn't, you know, this is about particular policies on campus or a failure to deal with particular incidents. Just feels like lots of people are stretched, not feeling very confident, not feeling very secure, and so don't want to kind of wade into controversy. Do you think there's something in that? And is that, you know, is that different for different groups of staff and students, you think?
Yeah, okay. So there is a fragility to the culture of higher education amongst both staff and students. And there is anxiety abound in both sets of those communities. So staff are worried about the precarity of the sector. They are they feel attacked from outside of the institution. They feel that the potential for things to collapse is always imminent, and that creates a defensiveness, and it creates a condition in which people tend to retreat into themselves. In equal measure, students are under pressure. They are very, very aware that the things that they have to do to meet their life demands, the amount of work they need to put in, the ways that that pulls them away from the full student experience, and even the kind of core student experience of being able to attend your course, the ways in which that leaves them missing out, and particularly and potentially at a disadvantage against other more advantaged peers. And I think all of that creates a tinderbox set of pressures that lead us to worry about how we present ourselves in the world. And I think there's almost like there's a Maslow hierarchy of needs there, isn't there? Where if those more basic set of conditions of security and safety are not in place, the capacity to be able to engage in things where we may disagree becomes much, much more difficult. And I'm sure that there is an element.
Well, see, I don't know if this is unfair, but you know, sometimes when I read some of this stuff, I get a sense that there are people in particular types of higher education with interacting with particular types of students from particular types of background that are on particular types of contract that can't imagine what some of that, you know, kind of alternative, those experiences, that kind of precarity kind of look and feel like. I don't know. I mean, it's hard to spot where the actual research has been done that underpins why some of this stuff is happening, even if you accept that it is happening.
I think, you know, it is about the employment-focused, industry-relevant courses, the nature of courses that students are studying. So I think it's not that, you know, there's absolutely no room for anything controversial that might happen on FE campuses or in FE classrooms, but the very nature of what it is that the teachers are teaching, the content of the subject, that probably doesn't render itself as much to something that might be politically sensitive, for example. So I think, you know, those incidents are probably far and few. There might be things outside of the classroom, and given the global conflicts, for example, you can imagine some scenarios sort of, you know, becoming more real, and that will be happening right across the board because colleges are no exception. They are absolutely grounded in their communities, and therefore you can witness some of those kind of incidents. But I think just as far as, like, you know, the academic debate and the point about kind of, you know, expressing your speech in relation to controversial matters is concerned, there's very little that takes place in FE classrooms because of the very nature of what it is that's being taught in higher education within further education.
I think one of the things that the paper does do that I think is a really useful call to action is something lots of institutions doing already, which is how do we create a scaffold that teaches students how to disagree well? And there's loads of really good examples across the sector of framework of how to do that. I think within that, there's a really specific challenge to recognize that different students have different feelings of entitlement to express their opinion. And that isn't necessarily something that universities are imposing on them. It's kind of structural in society. If you come from a less represented area of the country where your family haven't necessarily engaged with that kind of space before, you may not necessarily have the level of if you come with an imposter syndrome, your capacity to be able to express your opinion is different. And I think there's something in how we respond to that in this that could be really productive, not just in addressing free speech, but actually in some of the leveling the playing fields that higher education really want to do.
And that is interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, I still frequently, and if it's, you know, if you keep your eyes below the line on the site, we still frequently see comments that reflect a kind of, oh, students aren't like they used to be. Do you know what I mean? And you know, that feels a lot like, well, no, they're not. They're more diverse. Lots of the students you would have taught are now in a different type of institution. You know, that kind of thing about kind of responding to the level of confidence that people have when they get into university becomes really important, I guess, doesn't it? The other thing that really strikes me, Livia, I mean, there's some fun bits in here about what I might call dissent.
Yeah, it's not really about a policy, basically. Like, I think part of it depends, you know, where people have worked. Like, academics are, and kind of within universities, I think that it is quite unique to be able to be quite open and actively critical about the place and the culture in which you work. I don't think that's that normal in a lot of workplaces. Now, not saying that kind of most workplaces, you know, you can't share your views and all that sort of stuff, but it wouldn't wouldn't be normal, I don't think, to kind of go on Twitter and basically say, the CEO of my company is horrible. I hate him. They've got really poor management skills, blah, blah, blah. You just wouldn't do that. But I think the thing that is really, so I think that's quite unique about universities, that culture to openly criticize management is kind of normal, or normalized at least for some. I think one of the things that was really interesting to me was the stuff around the student representative posting, you know, kind of commentary about accommodation being crap or being like worse for wear and not being repaired and all of that sort of stuff, and whether that constitutes as reputation damaging. I think it's not there's an unwritten rule. For example, if you're a student union officer, if you're a student rep, you toe the line and you play nice because they control your block grant. Obviously, you know, there's a line to play, but you can just imagine it, can't you, that if, like, when I was an officer, if I'd gone out and just started screaming about the university executive and kind of slammed them online in a bunch of tweets or a TikTok or whatever, I would have got called into my chief exec's office and been like, Livia, what the hell? Why have you done that? We're literally about to come into kind of negotiations around block grants, all of that sort of stuff. It would have been, you need to channel that into, I don't know, a partnerships catch up, or you need to channel that into a campaign. And I think that is really interesting, because it's much more about the kind of culture of what you can and can't do that is never explicitly said, but it is kind of imposed, if that makes sense.
Livia, just before we finish on this, obviously there's a bunch of people who believe that, you know, there's quite a lot of anti-Semitic incidents on campus, and so you need a definition of anti-Semitism to, you know, help with judging whether they're anti-Semitic or not. And then there's a bunch of other people that will say that the definition, the IRA definition of anti-Semitism, is contested. And so, you know, it falls into the category of lots of other things that universities shouldn't automatically sign up to, because it presupposes people's values. And astonishingly, the guidance actually equivocates, doesn't it? It doesn't actually get us further on that at all.
No, there's no, if, you know, that would be the one thing, I think, that we all know that is the one thing as a university I would want to kind of have a sense on what to do with that, so that I am falling within the law and kind of both protecting all students, but kind of also not breaking any laws. There's nothing. I did a control F search for anti-Semitism in the guidance, and there is, you know, it talks about it, but it doesn't really move the dial and kind of tell us any more that says, this is what we should do, this is the definition, this is what to think, what to do with kind of the IRA definition, whether you can adopt it, whether you can't adopt it. It is still so convoluted, and I can just see that becoming a ping pong thing again, that will be in the news and it will be accusing universities of X, Y, and Z, and we'll be back to, I don't know, the government saying we're going to have a task force on anti-Semitism, which is what they said last year, and then universities are all sat there like, yes, we're happy to kind of work on it, but you haven't told us how to stay within the law.
I just wanted to add that we need to remind ourselves, like, who are the teachers, who are the tutors who are teaching higher education within further education, and in the main, these will be industry experts who are not teaching sort of, you know, philosophical subjects. It's not philosophical content. It's really sort of, you know, very industry specific. It's very sort of, you know, employment specific, and they're not conducting any sensitive pieces of social research that they are often drawing on. So I think that the nature, the dynamic of the classroom and the interaction between the tutors and students happens to be different for that reason as well.
Yeah, the sort of judgment that we make on, you know, their levels of confidence around this sort of stuff needs to start there, doesn't it? Yeah.
It's about objectivity rather, yeah, it's about the objectivity of the content rather than the subjective. That's probably kind of more likely to happen with social sciences or philosophical debates that tend to take place more so within HEIs than in further education colleges.
Well, tricky stuff. Plenty more on the site as ever about all of that. Now, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
I'm Richard Wallace from Bournemouth University, and this week on Wonky, my colleague Krista Van Ralter and I have been blogging about the relationship between higher education and the screen industries. Every so often, those of us who teach practical media courses are told that we need to work more closely with industry and that our courses need to be more industry relevant. Now, we agree that collaboration with industry can be incredibly valuable for our students, but we argue that layers of misunderstanding about both HE and the media industries has resulted in several unhelpful myths about what each of these sectors is able to offer the other. In our blog, we break these myths down, suggesting a more constructive approach. We argue for a better quality of conversation about what closer collaboration between these two important sectors could actually look like.
Now, next up, the R&D world is shifting under our feet. Mark, what's going on here?
Yeah, so earlier this week, Artaline Lacer, the outgoing chief executive of UK Research and Innovation, gave her final, it's been called her valedictory address to the House of Commons Science Committee. And it was unexpectedly candid about the scale of resource and funding challenges to higher education. And essentially, her conclusion was the house of cards that we have constructed, in which we prop up the lack of sufficient governmental research funding with other sources of income. She notes particularly international recruitment, which of course people worry is about to fall off. The precarity of that means that it is inevitable that the sector will see some form of consolidation in its research focus. Now she's quite guarded about this. She doesn't necessarily paint a picture around that, and she paints a picture in which that reduction is about institutions leaning into their areas of excellence, becoming more coordinated, more place-based, and making the most of their distinct talent. And she makes a couple of kind of claims that maybe we might want to dig into a bit more. There's one about that this is probably not going to be an unmanaged climb, because DESA and DfE are so good at working together, that they would be able to coordinate this across the sector, which I'm sure we'll want to get into. She also points to this not being a driver of course closures, because these are largely being driven by market rather than kind of any research context around that. But certainly a kind of a look towards an inevitable shift in the future in that address.
Yes. Now, I think we've got a clip, haven't we? Let's hear a clip.
We need assessment systems that support universities to develop their unique strategy linked to where they are in the country, which other universities are near to them, and what their opportunities are. Yeah. And so that transition, managing that transition effectively, I think is going to be a real challenge.
Thank you. And to be clear, by consolidation, you mean a reduction in the number of universities?
Not necessarily. Yeah. For example, if universities are trying to compete by relatively unstrategic expansion in their research activity, they might be researching across a very wide range of topics, and it might be much more sensible for them to focus on a smaller range of topics.
So that would be a reduction in the number of departments?
Potentially, or within departments. I mean, you can think about this at multiple different scales.
That's a set of sentences that need back. Look, Artie, one of the things I think is really interesting about this is that to the extent to which we can read the runes about, you know, the kind of skills white paper and how that might affect higher education, it's pretty clear that there will be, you know, a push towards a focus on place following, you know, well over a decade of a kind of free market in HE, which hasn't really tried to do place-based planning, right? And of course, in further education, it strikes me that if you're not thinking very, very carefully about the skills needs of a region or a place, you're kind of, you know, you're doomed. But I'm really interested here in the levers, right? Because, you know, one of the things that she said in the committee was, well, you know, I mean, you know, it might be very difficult to teach blah, 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 because students don't want to study it. And, you know, if there's low demand to take up a qualification, but all the employers are saying we really need people that have this qualification, what do you do? I mean, what do you do over in FE?
I think I'd probably just comment on this from an AG lens, like higher education within further education. I think one of the challenges, I think fair to say, is if employers are demanding something, then arguably colleges will be attuned to it. They will be alert to it, and the chances are that they will try to cater to the needs, the skills needs of the regions the best that they can. But there are bigger questions about economies of scale. Now, college higher education in particular, you're talking about very small class sizes, very small cohorts. And I think, you know, once it gets to a certain number, the tipping point, then I think it makes a course economically unviable. So I think, you know, there's definitely sort of, you know, those tensions between what the employers are asking for and what the students may be interested in studying. I think there are levers that are, I think, that can be applied. For example, things like if you want to, let's say, increase student interest or the applicant interest in certain types of courses, then offering funding, for example, you know, things like maintenance grants, for example, could be one of the ways in which you can probably get students to consider courses that they otherwise might not be prepared to consider. So funding definitely sort of drives behaviors. And as much as it applies to providers, it applies to students as well. So I think, you know, informing student choice is just quite important. So if the students understand, for example, the outcomes after having completed a certain certain course will look favorable, the chances are that students will be more interested in taking up those courses. So I think that's probably another ways in which you can probably inform student choice, especially where, let's say, the demand or the appetite for those courses might be limited. And the other, which is another quite important one, I would argue, is the role of employers in this. So I would argue that it's probably not adequate for employers to say that there are skill shortages in particular areas and they are seeking those skills, but there aren't enough people to fulfill those vacancies, etc. It's also about employers doing their bit in making their sectors, their employment offers more attractive. It could be to do with terms and conditions of employment, or indeed looking at ways in which they can collaboratively work with providers to raise awareness and profile of their industry as well as the jobs that they are looking to fulfill.
Yeah. And it strikes me, Olivia, that, you know, that as a result, when there's a bit of extra money around to do quite a bit of cross subsidy, you can invest in, you know, something that's unpopular and hope to try and grow it. And you can get into a room with kind of different types of provider in, say, a region or whatever, and kind of coordinate. But all of that is really, really difficult when everyone's kind of backs against the wall and they're, you know, there's no kind of cross subsidy floating around to kind of do that thing, to do anything other than, well, we'll respond to the raw demand that kind of comes through in terms of, you know, what students want to study.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the other things she suggested, is that, you know, the CMA needs to adjust its thinking, because at the moment, universities really struggle to kind of coordinate together what they do with their teaching programs. You know, the challenge of kind of the regulation around mergers, which we talked about in the past. That's another thing that she kind of outlines and says, well, in order to do this, that needs to change to enable universities to actually work together rather than just kind of do what we've always done, which is compete for students and kind of have both the same courses competing for the same students. I think what is really interesting, I think it's a really provocative kind of statement that she made. You know, it's kind of good to make when you're leaving and you're probably not going to be the one to kind of to lead some of this change. I think it is a question and it's a debate that I imagine we will be having a lot over the next few months, because I think this sense that essentially one set of universities, the traditional research intensive, should be doing the majority of the research and that is kind of what they should be doing and do well, that seems to be the kind of direction that Patrick Vallance is going in. And I think my take is that Ottoline Laser is saying, right, this is something that the government should be doing and need support on. I don't know if the government really want to kind of intervene and sort this out to the kind of extent to which she is pushing this responsibility on government, you know, particularly given we've had the kind of Home Office essentially making it harder to recruit international students over the kind of past few years. And without those subsidies, a lot of this kind of stuff that she's suggesting just becomes unviable.
Mark, this thing about deep collaborations between DSIT and DfE, I mean, you know, we don't know what goes on behind the scenes. There's not a lot of evidence of that, you know, above the surface, is there?
No, and it was, I found it a really surprising claim because it does invite skepticism. I think from most outside observers, I think we see no evidence of any real systematic collaboration again across government departments. And maybe you're right, maybe it's hidden, but it certainly creates a set of questions around the capacity and willing of government to lean in and manage this process. And I think there are some real risks if that doesn't happen, either at a kind of national government level or with regions kind of taking responsibility themselves around how they coordinate that. And of course, there's absolutely nothing wrong with a coordinated distribution of expertise across the sector. I think most people would see that as a really good thing. But without that management, I think there's a real risk that we end up with some real regional disparities in what students can actually access. I think, of course, pre-92, we had a group of institutions who did teaching and a group of institutions who did research. And if we're not careful, as Livia alludes, we could see a retreat back to that. And then when you look regionally, it could be a situation in which some areas of the country are not able to access a university education where the educators all produce knowledge. I also think the view that the market purely drives the course portfolios of university is a little bit reductive, because of course universities hire staff base on the basis of their visibility within those research spaces as well as their teaching. And those things become really important in things like international recruitment. So there is a dynamic there where if you're not careful, you do start to lose courses on the basis that they're not viable as kind of research beacons that become visible in some of those international league tables.
Can I also ask you, Mark, just quickly, you know, one of the things that often strikes me when we're doing our European study tour yours is, because lots of degrees in other countries are both more generalist in perhaps, you know, their first, you know, the first period of the degree, and allow, you know, the kind of combination of module acquisition from different subject areas, you know, they're just generally more generalist. You know, we've been to some countries where there's pretty much no one doing a languages degree, but the languages department has got research active academics because loads and loads and loads of students do, you know, a small number of credits in a foreign language. Now, it's part of the problem here, not so much about overall programs, but just about the way that we structure degrees in terms of that kind of heavy specialism that we do.
Yeah, and I've spoken to this elsewhere. I think we're very uptight in how we understand what a student journey can and should be. And there's a long legacy of UK higher education that defines a student journey as a journey through a discipline rather than a journey of their development. And I think it's one of those uptightnesses that is backing us into a corner. So I think absolutely, Jim, there are gains to be made by relaxing that a little bit and recognising that you can, by taking strategies like that, you can create viabilities in your subject by allowing access across those disciplinary spaces with really, really productive learning gains for students at the end.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to go in deep on anything we've discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to get ahead of everything going on in UKHE, just click subscriptions on the site to find out more. So huge thanks to Mark Peace, Arti Saraswat and Livia Scott, Michael Salmon for making it all happen behind the scenes. We'll be back next week. Mark will be here. Until then, stay wonky.